This is Kurt Benrud, and welcome to another edition of Did You Know? This week's program is going to look at some events in history that may not have happened in exactly the way we were led to believe.
This is Parra Talls, and this program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience. We also have some stories about some literary characters and the actual persons upon whom these stories were based.
And this is Bob Martin. And before we get to the stories, I have to tell you about what happened to me last night.
Oh, what was that? Another crisis?
Oh, no, nothing like that. I was working in my computer, and I just stopped to think what a marvelous invention the computer is. I don't think there's anything that it can't do.
You're right, but I once heard a comedian say that he thought it was a waste of money. He could just as easily have bought a $1,500 deck of cards.
Can you get the internet on a deck of cards?
No. What he was saying was that all he used his computer for was to play solitaire.
Well, that's just wrong. I didn't pay anywhere near $1,500 for my computer.
Plus, with a computer, you don't always end up losing one of the cards, right, Bob?
I didn't think of that. Besides, solitaire is silly. There are so many other really neat games you can play.
Bob, there are a lot of other interesting things on a computer besides games. You can take a virtual tour of the Roman Colosseum, or visit the pyramids, or explore the oceans.
Oh, I know. I have a game where you can drive race cars around the Colosseum, just like Ben-Hur. In fact, Ben-Hur drives one of the other cars. And I have a game where you can dig for buried treasure by finding and opening hidden pyramids. And another one where you can have an underwater war using submarines.
Besides the games, Bob, there is a lot of useful information you can get off the internet.
Well, I know that too. Where do you think I find all the cheats for my games? I bet the first time people saw the home computer, they knew they had a winner on their hands.
Shall we surprise him, Parra?
I think so, Kurt. This is exactly what this week's program is all about.
Bob, we're going to tell you some things that were said about the computer when it was first introduced. Now pay attention. In 1943, Thomas Watson, the chairman of IBM, said, "I think there is a world market for maybe 5 computers."
In 1949, Popular Mechanics said that in the future, computers may weigh no more than 1.5 tons.
In 1968, an engineer at IBM saw the microchip and asked, "But what is it good for?"
And in 1977, Ken Olson, president of Digital Equipment Corporation, said, "There is no reason why anyone would want a computer in their home."
Well, that was before John Madden's football games.
Okay, how about this? Atari is big in games, right?
Right.
When Steve Jobs and Pete Wozniak tried to find interest in their new home computer, this is their statement of their success. "So we went to Atari and said, 'Hey, we got this thing, even built with some of your parts, and what do you think about funding us? Or, we'll give it to you, we just want to do it. Pay our salary, we'll come work for you.' And Atari said no. Then they went to Hewlett-Packard and they said, 'Hey, we don't need you. You haven't even gotten through college yet.'"
Atari and HP turned them down?
And in 1981, Bill Gates even said that he thought that 640K of RAM would be enough for anybody. What do you think now?
I think maybe I'll turn off the games for a while and see what else there is.
Well, one thing is the story of Paul Revere's ride. Tell us what you remember about it.
Okay. The British were heading from Boston to Lexington to arrest Sam Adams and destroy the munition supply of the colonists at Concord. So Paul Revere took off on horseback, and after seeing the signal at the Old North Church about one up by land and two up by sea, he rode all alone to Lexington and Concord to warn the people. Along the way, he shouted, "The British are coming! The British are coming!"
Anything else?
Oh, yeah. Longfellow wrote a poem about the event. It started out, "Gather my children and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere." And I know that even today there are some school teachers that are telling their classes all about Paul Revere by teaching them right from that poem.
Yes, I know that is happening, and that's too bad.
Why?
Because it didn't happen that way. Let's tell him the real story.
Okay. Well, first of all, Paul Revere was not the only rider. On the night of April 18th, 1775, Joseph Warren of the Sons of Liberty directed 2 riders to go from Boston to Lexington and Concord and warn Samuel Adams and John Hancock of the British movements. Paul Revere was to go across the Charles River and up, William Dawes was to go over the land route.
That may sound complicated until you remember that in those days, Boston was nearly an island connected to the mainland only by one strip of road on the northwest side of Boston, and then up through Charleston. Also, Charleston, where Bunker Hill is located, was then a separate city. It is now a part of the city of Boston.
The two routes were selected in case one of the riders was caught by the British, and the signal in the tower of the Old North Church was not to Revere, it was from him. The purpose was to warn the colonists in Charleston in case both of the riders were caught. As it was, both of them made it as far as Lexington, where they met with Adams and Hancock.
Now, the story gets fascinating. Before leaving Lexington on their way to Concord, they met one Samuel Prescott, who was out at 1 o'clock in the morning. What was Mr. Prescott doing out at those wee small hours? Though he was one of the Patriots, he wasn't out on Patriot business. He was just leaving his girlfriend's house.
Well, I'm sure it's not what you think. They had bundling beds back then.
Oh, yes, they did. So since Prescott was awake anyway, he joined Dawes and Revere on the way to Concord. Shortly thereafter, all three were stopped by a British roadblock. Revere was captured, and that was it for him for the rest of the night. Dawes got away, but he was unfamiliar with the terrain, and soon his horse threw him, and that was as far as he got.
This was Prescott's turf. He jumped a fence and off he went through the woods. He was the only rider to make it to Concord. If he hadn't been there for love's calling, Prescott would not have joined the party, and there may not have been a shot heard round the world from the old bridge in Concord.
Also, this was a secret mission. If the British heard, they would have been arrested. There was no shouting of, "The British are coming." And Revere and Dawes were on a direct mission to Lexington. As they stopped and notified other families along the way, they in turn sent out riders in different directions. It's estimated that there may have been as many as 40 riders out that night.
All that misinformation from the poem?
It's still a great poem. Think of the feeling it engenders.
I didn't think of it at the time. But, you know, several years ago I was visiting Boston. One of the tour guides mentioned that when the poem was written, some 80 years after the event, one of the purposes was to encourage enlistment in the Civil War.
Feelings can do that.
It was also mentioned that Longfellow's grandfather had been on the panel that tried to court-martial Paul Revere. He was acquitted.
The events of April 18th and 19th, 1775, still stand out as one of the great moments in American history. If the riders had not been successful, the revolution might have failed.
Important things surely happened then, just not quite the way Longfellow described them. Also, did you know that after his ride, Paul Revere billed the State House for expenses, 10 shillings?
Any other events where a poem or story was the basis of what we know about a person?
As a matter of fact, how about William Wallace?
Who? I've never heard of William Wallace.
Neither had a group of teenagers who were sitting next to his statue in Scotland. When asked what they thought of their local hero, they also had never heard of him.
You might know of him from the movie Braveheart.
Him? I've heard of him.
And did you know that most of the information for the film came from a view of Wallace that appeared in the Scotchacorum of Walter Bower? His information about Wallace came from anti-English sources that were highly praiseworthy, but not always accurate of Wallace.
And Bower's material was written 135 years after Wallace was dead.
Gee, that's even longer than Longfellow's poem was after Paul Revere's ride.
Oh, and it gets better, or worse, depending on your point of view. The anti-British propaganda of Bower was the basis of an epic poem entitled The Wallace by Blind Harry.
Now we're 170 years after the fact with a work that historians consider partially, if not totally, fictional. But in old Scottish homes, the book often held a place of importance right next to the Bible.
But he did lead the Scottish Rebellion for Independence.
Oh, yes, he did. And he was a brilliant military commander. His tactics at the battle at Stirling Bridge in 1297 were superb. Greatly outnumbered, he waited until half the English army came across a narrow bridge, then attacked. With nowhere to go and more troops pushing from behind, it was a massacre.
But his tactics were not always so noble, but they were effective. He would attack English villages to take food back to starving Scotsmen, and then to make sure the English had no help from the villagers, he killed them all.
So later, when the English came through, the land is now barren and the villages are desolate. Very effective. Still, he was considered a great national hero.
Actually, that didn't come until later. As Wallace became more popular, petty jealousies from the nobles surfaced. Seems his popularity was considered a threat to the current parties in power. So Wallace was betrayed to the English, who took him back to England for trial.
He was convicted of being a traitor and dealt with the most humane way possible, considering they were a nation of God-fearing men.
He was beaten, tortured, disemboweled, and finally killed, hacked into pieces and decapitated. All this was done in public.
I bet that got the attention of the Scottish people.
It sure did, but not in the way the English wanted. It was then that Wallace became a rallying cry. He was a national hero.
But not to the teenager sitting right next to the statue in his hometown. I guess they hadn't seen the movie yet. Any other stories where embellishments were made to history?
That's a nice way of putting it, embellishments. Okay, how about Lady Godiva?
According to what I was told, many years ago, a prince of Coventry was so mean, he taxed the villagers outrageously. His wife, Godiva, pleaded with him to lower the taxes. He said he would if she would ride naked through the town, market square and all. This she did. But she first requested the townspeople to respect her and go inside and not look during her ride. All of the townspeople did as she requested, except for one rogue named Tom. He peeked through the shutters, and when he did, he was struck blind. He was the original Peeping Tom.
My first question is, who struck Tom blind? Nobody saw him peek. Plus, what good is a protest if nobody sees it? That sounds like some kind of later addition was made.
Oh, indeed it was. Here's the earlier story as we have it. First, there really was such a person as Godiva, though her earlier name would have appeared as G-O-D-G-Y-Fu or Godifu. And she would have lived from 1040 to 1080. There was really such a place as Coventry. It was founded in 1043.
Godiva was married to Leofric, the lord who ruled over Coventry. But there is no mention anywhere in history of heavy taxes. Instead, we have records only of Leofric's benevolence in granting land and giving gifts to the abbeys in the area. And there is no mention of Tom. He comes much later.
First problem. Since Coventry only came into existence in 1043, it is doubtful that the area would have been developed into anything more than a mere settlement by the time that Godiva made her ride. It certainly would not have been a town, let alone a town big enough for a central market square through which to ride.
A naked lady riding through town would have been a big event. How come there is no contemporary mention of it? The first record appears in the writings of Roger Wendover, who was a collector of antidotes. He died in 1236, so the written story doesn't appear for 150 years.
And in the original, the town wasn't deserted. The people were out, and her horse was escorted by two knights. The request for a vacant town was added later.
But how did the whole thing originate? She must have done something through the town.
How's this for a possibility? It was a practice at that time that a penitent, wearing a sleeveless white smock, something like a modern slip, would walk through the center of town. It is possible that all that originally happened was she was performing a penance prescribed by a priest for some sin committed. Common practice, no big deal, for 150 years.
Well, that doesn't explain the Peeping Tom.
True, but Tom doesn't become a part of the story for another 400 years, and it might have come from a practical joker. Someone salvaged a statue of St. George from a monastery when it closed down in 1539. They placed it in a window overlooking the now famous Market Square.
When anyone would ask of the statue, the owner would say, "Oh, that's Tom, and he's peeking at Godiva." Possibly the start of a legend, but not the way you learned about it. Not as interesting as the legendary story, is it?
Well, how about the mutiny on the Bounty? That's got to be a pretty clear cut.
Well, maybe, as far as it goes. What do you remember?
Well, Captain Bligh was a brutal man who whipped and mistreated his crew until they finally couldn't take it anymore. One day, under the leadership of the first mate, Fletcher Christian, they mutinied. They put the captain out to sea in a longboat, along with the rest of the crew that remained loyal to him. Then the mutineers sailed on to Pitcairn Island, where they lived the rest of their lives.
And what happened to the captain?
Actually, I think he made it back to England. It's been a long time since I've seen the movie.
And Bligh was the bad guy, and Fletcher Christian was the hero?
Absolutely.
What makes you so sure?
Because Captain Bligh was played by Charles Laughton, and Mr. Christian was played by Clark Gable. All you have to do is look at them, and you know who the bad guy is.
Okay, looks can be sometimes deceiving.
Oh, yeah? Like that famous man who once said, things aren't always the way they seem, they just look that way?
All right, let's look at the actual record. There were such people as Bligh and Christian, and they did sail on the HMS Bounty, and there was a mutiny.
Well, that does it. One story that's just the way we learned it.
Just listen a minute. Just a minor point, Bligh was not really a captain. Did you know that the Bounty was actually a very small ship? It was a converted merchant ship mounted with four guns and actually having only one gunner on board. Bligh had the rank of commanding lieutenant.
Also, the records seem to show that the number of beatings he ordered were very few. If anything, his downfall may have occurred because he was too lenient.
Well, how can that be?
Their orders were to go to Tahiti and pick up a load of breadfruit and to take it to Jamaica to see if it could be used as a food source to feed the slaves there. When they arrived in Tahiti, they had a layover for 5 months to wait for the fruit to ripen.
Instead of keeping strict discipline during those months, he let the crew have what amounted to a vacation in paradise. Food hanging from trees, no work to do, and quite lenient dating customs. Several of the crew attained girlfriends and even wives during the stay. That included Fletcher Christian.
When it was time to go, why leave paradise and go back to work? So 3 weeks later, enough of this work. Let's get back to the girls and the easy life. They mutinied. After casting up Bligh, the crew returned to Tahiti, where some of them got off. The rest went looking for a new home and found it in Pitcairn Island.
After 47 days adrift, Bligh actually made it to Timor, and then passage to England. The Admiralty then sent out a warship to look for the mutineers. The ship found 14 of these mutineers on Tahiti. Since Pitcairn was not on any map, they didn't know about the island and set sail for home. 10 of the men made it to trial, and 3 were hung.
When Pitcairn Island was finally discovered in 1808, only one of the crew was found alive. It was not Fletcher Christian.
Here's a little fact for you. Did you know when the designation of the Bounty was given as HM instead of HMS, that was not a mistake? Maybe because of the smallness of the vessel, historians call it His or Her Majesty, and a few called it HMAV for armed vessel.
I've got another one for you. Did you know Captain Bligh actually did become captain and even vice admiral, and they finally did get the breadfruit to Jamaica? It was on a later voyage a couple of years later.
How about leaving Captain Bligh with his breadfruit and take time for some did-you-know quickies? Bell time. Did you know that Connecticut, Georgia, and Massachusetts waited until 1941 to ratify the Bill of Rights?
Did you know that the original Bill of Rights would have prohibited politicians from raising their own salaries? That didn't happen until the 27th Amendment. That was passed in 1992.
That Abigail Adams used to hang her laundry in the East Room of the White House.
That Ben Jonson was buried standing up in Westminster Abbey. He couldn't afford a full plot.
That the D and D-Day stood for day, so June 6, 1944 was Day Day.
That during France's year-long reign of terror, 17,000 people were sent to the guillotine.
That in spite of what you may have heard, Mussolini never did make the trains run on time.
Did you know that the world powers outlawed war, except in self-defense, under the Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928? It didn't work.
That the Aztecs sacrificed up to 15,000 people a year to their sun god.
That Rodin's The Thinker was actually titled The Poet and was intended to be a part of a great doorway.
That ancient Egypt had at least 6 different types of beer.
Yes.
that after Charles Lindbergh's famous flight, the first passenger in the Spirit of St. Louis was Henry Ford.
That in 17th century America, the average woman gave birth to 13 children.
That when gold was discovered in California, it was still officially Mexican territory.
That Nero couldn't have fiddled while Rome burned. Fiddles hadn't been invented yet.
Oh, liar, liar.
That Socrates never wrote down a single word of his teachings.
Did you know that of the last 3,500 years, only 230 of them saw no major wars?
Now, how about some inventions that someone in the company got terribly wrong? Like the telephone. The telephone has too many shortcomings to be seriously considered as a means of communication. The device is inherently of no value to us, so said Western Union in 1876.
How about the airplane? Heavier-than-air flying machines are impossible. Lord Levin, president of the Royal Society of Physicists, 1895. Or, man won't fly for 1,000 years, Wilbur Wright to his brother Orville following a disappointing experiment in 1901.
On the bomb. The bomb will never explode. I am saying this as an expert on the subject. Admiral David Leahy, advising President Truman.
How about a story that became bigger than the actual person? For example, the Robert Louis Stevenson story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The story tells of a scientist who developed an elixir that can completely change his personality. At one moment, he is a kindly, loving, prospective husband. The next moment, he is a sadistic, evil monster.
Stevenson had long been interested in the duality of human nature that could produce both wonderfully kind acts and evilly cruel acts from the same person. When he was still a teenager, he wrote a little piece about a man named Deacon Brodie. In no way was Brodie the prototype of Jekyll and Hyde, but he was an interesting character for the young Stevenson to study.
William Brodie was born into a very respectable 18th century Scottish family. He became a notable cabinet maker, the deacon of his Masonic lodge, and a member of the Edinburgh City Council. In short, he was a model citizen. But
he also liked to gamble, and on the side, he kept two mistresses. After a while, his gambling losses started to pile up, and when the mistresses started producing little Brodies, he found himself in desperate financial straits. What to do?
What to do was on the visits to wealthy community members in their homes, he began to notice things of interest and to make wax impressions of their keys. Then when no one was home, he entered and literally cleaned house.
Two things occurred as the result of his secret life. Obviously, he solved his financial woes, but it also produced a thrill from the danger involved.
Ultimately, he was turned in by an accomplice, and he escaped to Holland, intent on heading to America. There he was caught and returned to Edinburgh, where he was convicted and hung.
The character obviously interested Stevenson and added to all his thoughts about his strange problem of what goes on within a person that allows two entirely different kinds of behavior. Again, Brodie is not Jekyll Hyde, but the problem of split personality started with Brodie and is brought to a frightening conclusion in the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
I remember the first time I read that story. I remember another story that made me go, Dracula. Is there a story behind him?
Yes, and it's quite gory, but not in the regular vampire fashion. Bram Stoker wrote the story of Dracula, and it's crucial for the story that it be placed in Transylvania.
You mean we had a vampire right here in North Carolina?
We do have a Transylvania county in our state, but this Transylvania is in Europe. The figure of the vampire was a large one in Slavic folklore. Beginning in the late 17th century, there was an epidemic of reported cases, starting with Hungary and spreading through the Balkans to Germany, Italy, France, England, and Spain.
Stoker's interest in this strange mythical creature was piqued by the many stories, and he may have found the name for his vampire in a book by William Wilkinson, whose research in the territory of Wallachia, a part of present-day Romania, provided the perfect figure for Bram Stoker's character.
In the early 15th century, a man called Vlad was in the line for the throne, but so were several other cousins. So he bided his time as governor of Transylvania. In 1431, he was inducted into the Order of the Dragon. he began calling himself the Dragon, which in Romanian was Dracul. 2 months later, a son was born, and he named him Son of the Dragon, Dracula.
Young Dracula spent some time under the Ottomans and grew to hate them. But he also watched the cruelty with which they dealt with their enemies and learned a few things. When he finally became king of Wallachia, he found his former home in a mess. He built new cities, developed trade and agriculture, and set out destroying the old nobles whose power struggles had seriously weakened the kingdom.
As he became more powerful, the Ottomans set out to take out Wallachia. They marched with 90,000 men. Dracula had only 20,000 to 40,000, but guess what the Ottomans found as they approached? It was a trick he had learned in Turkey. There to meet the Ottoman army were 20,000 Ottoman soldiers impaled out in the fields. These men weren't dead. They were alive and kicking, literally, impaled in the air on stakes. Imagine what that would do to you psychologically.
Thus came Dracula's nickname, Vlad the Impaler. This is the prototype for Bram Stoker's character. Combine that with the Slavic folklore tales of vampirism during the 17th and 18th century. Stoker had a hit. And what a great name for a location, Transylvania. Did you know it means across the forest?
How about another American historical story? This one takes place at the Alamo. Again, a film is largely responsible for the story most people believe about what occurred at the Alamo, with John Wayne leading the way as Davy Crockett. Who can question it?
Here's the situation. There was already a war going on. Mexican revolutionaries against the existing Mexican government. Also at this period of time, Texas was a part of Mexico, not the United States. Add to this fact that many Americans were flooding into Texas to get land and protect a right they held, the right to own slaves. Apparently Crockett had owned 3 slaves. Bowie was an active slave trader, and Travis even bought one of his slaves to him to Alamo.
The fighters at the Alamo were a part of the revolutionists, and the Mexican government had already sent messages to Washington telling them that Americans fighting against the Mexican government would be shot. It was very much like what the American patriots knew when the American Revolution started. If they won, they'd be heroes. If they lost, they would be hung.
Petitions made for the United States to annex Texas were declined because they didn't want to become involved in a war with Mexico.
And in the background of the whole affair was that Mexico was moving to ban slavery. American ranchers and slaveholders in Texas didn't want that.
A slightly different view of what led up to the Alamo.
Well, how about some more short quotes that history proved wrong? On oil drilling. Drill for oil? You mean drill into the ground to try and find oil? You're crazy. This was said by drillers when Edwin Drake tried to enlist them in his project in 1859.
On bacteriology, Louis Pasteur, theory of germs is ridiculous fiction. Pierre Pache, professor of physiology in 1872.
On surgery, the abdomen, the chest, and the brain will forever be shut from the intrusion of the wise and humane surgeon. This from Sir John Ericsson, appointed surgeon extraordinaire to Queen Victoria, 1873.
On the stock market, stocks have reached what looks like a permanent high plateau. I. Fisher, professor of economics at Yale, 1929.
Regarding the Federal Express, the concept is interesting and well-formed, but in order to earn better than a C, the idea must be feasible. A Yale management professor in response to Fred Smith's proposed project, Smith went on to form Federal Express Corporation.
Everything that can be invented has been invented. Charles Duell, Commissioner, U.S. Patent Office, 1899.
Here's a story of another real-life person who became a fictional celebrity. See if you can guess who. His name was Andrew Selkirk. He was born in Scotland in 1676 and ran off to sea almost as soon as he could run. By age 27, he was the first mate aboard a ship called the Cinque Ports, the Five Ports.
I don't think that's a very good name for a ship.
What's wrong with Five Ports?
Oh, it's okay when you translate it, but to me, Cinque sounds like sunk. And that's not a good name for a ship.
You may be right, but the ship didn't sink, but it almost did. The ship was a privateer and was heading around Cape Horn to get a Spanish and Portuguese ship to loot. After several failures, they finally made it, though damaged.
Selkirk wanted to stop and do repairs, but the captain, William Dampier, wanted to push on. Figuring the ship would sink, in October of 1704, Selkirk asked to be put ashore on the island of Masatierra. He figured that since they were on a regular shipping route, it wouldn't be long before he was picked up.
But it didn't happen very quickly.
No, it didn't. Not for 4.5 years. The island had lots of fresh fruits and goats and fresh water, so he lived in a cave and made do. Finally, early in 1709, an English ship did arrive. Imagine the crew's surprise when this wild-looking bearded creature came running down the beach towards them. After 4.5 years, he could barely speak English anymore.
Guess who happened to be on board the rescue ship? The pilot of the ship was William Dampier. Selkirk was taken on board and taken back to England. Once there, he told his story to essayist Richard Steele, who wrote a story about the adventure.
Steele's story was in turn read by one Daniel Defoe, who wrote his own fictional story, Robinson Crusoe.
Andrew Selkirk had no Man Friday, but he did become Robinson Crusoe. Any other stories?
How about Spartacus? Contrary to the movies, Spartacus was not a slave, the son of a slave. He was a tribal warrior from Thrace. There is a gap in his history, but his tribe must have been defeated by Rome, because the next we see of him, he is a Roman soldier. He deserts the army, is captured, returned to Rome, and then sold as a slave.
The movie had to have him single so they can create a love affair, but the actual Spartacus was married, his wife was a priestess. He did leave a slave revolt with considerable success, but when his end came, it was nothing like the movie.
In the final battle, Spartacus, along with the majority of the slaves, is killed. His body was never found, and no record is made of what happened to his wife. Some 6,000 slaves who tried to escape were captured and all crucified. The bodies were evenly spaced along the road from Capua to Rome.
There is no glorious last scene where slave after slave volunteers that he is Spartacus so the rest, includes the real Spartacus, can be saved. Spartacus was never found, and all the rest died.
Did you know that, according to Kirk Douglas, the movie's scene with all the cries of, "I am Spartacus," was actually filmed using the crowd at a Michigan State versus Notre Dame football game? Here's a voice for conservation that was overturned on a minor technicality. In the late 1920s, early 1930s, a figure appeared in Canada advocating conservation. His name was Gray Owl, and he claimed to be a native Apache. He had written several groundbreaking articles on the need to preserve the wilderness. These articles came to the attention of the Canadian National Park Service, and they hired him as their first official naturalist.
After publishing a best-selling book, he was invited on a speaking tour in England. It was a grinding schedule, sometimes up to 3 appearances a day. After a while, he was just worn out. He returned to his home in Prince Albert National Park in Canada. He developed pneumonia and died in 1938 at age 49.
Here's where the trouble started for poor Gray Owl. He was not who he said he was. His actual name was Archibald Stansfield Bellany, and he wasn't an Apache, he was an Englishman.
When he was a child growing up in Sussex, he dreamed of the free life, and when he was 17, he had saved enough money to head for Canada. In 1906, he arrived in Toronto, and by 1907, he was living with the Indians, learning to trap, canoe, and live in the wilderness. For the next 20 years, he lived in the northern Ontario wilds, making his living as a trapper, a guide, and a park ranger.
Then he met a woman who was half-blood Mohawk. She convinced him to give up the trapping and to concentrate on conservation. When he did, he became very dedicated to the cause, especially after seeing it up close, the devastating effects of the timber industry.
Until 1938, he was a spokesman for preservation, a respected authority on the need for preservation and conservation. And then he died, and the world found out that he was not Gray Owl, but Archibald Stansfield Bellany. But did that mean that all of his life's work was of no value?
It sure did. Immediately, his critics jumped on the opportunity. He was a charlatan, a liar, Therefore, everything he said about preservation and conservation was nothing but hysterical ranting.
It took more than half a century before the world began to realize the truth and what Grayl had tried to tell them.
And that goes to show you, if someone says something you don't want to hear, find a flaw in their character. That proves they're wrong.
Here's a story about the flight that never happened. In April of 1844, the New York Sun published a news story about the first transatlantic balloon flight. It seems that a Monck Mason and his crew tried to cross the English Channel in a hot air balloon. They got caught up in a strong wind, and when they finally landed, it was in South Carolina.
The article went into great detail about all aspects of the flight. Description of the balloon, type of ballast used, amount of gas needed. It was a very thorough and scientific article, and it caused quite a sensation. So many people crowded around the paper sellers that the man who wrote the article tried to buy a copy of the paper and couldn't. By the time the crowd thinned, the papers were all sold out.
Well, what's wrong with that? A story that important ought to be read by as many people as possible.
What was wrong with it is that in those days, a newspaper would print an important story first and worry about confirmations later. When their mail came in, there was no mention of any such flight. It had never taken place. 2 days later, the Sun had to print a retraction. They had been had.
Who would make up a story like that? And how was he able to be so specific with the details?
Well, it had to be someone who knew about newspapers. There was no telephone, and since newspapers wanted to be the first on the street with the story, they'd print first and worry about mistakes later.
It also had to be someone who was well-versed in scientific matters. Did you know that 7 years earlier, Monck Mason did successfully make a balloon trip across the English Channel? And his balloon was very similar to the one described in the Sun article. And did you know that 75 years later, when a hot air balloon finally did make a transatlantic crossing, the times were identical, 75 hours from shore to shore, just like the Sun had announced.
So, who did it?
A young man had recently moved to New York. He had a sick wife and her mother to take care of. He was in desperate need of money. He loved practical jokes, and he had a flair for writing carefully constructed stories.
His name was Edgar Allan Poe. And did you know, this was not to be his last great hoax? The next year he published an article entitled, The Facts in the Case of Monsieur Valdemar. With this article, he convinced many people that, through hypnotism, it was possible to communicate with the dead.
That's a side of Edgar Allan Poe you would never have considered. His stories always make you think of someone who is dreary and spooky.
And here you have a practical joker who can make people believe something that didn't really happen.
I think it's bell time. Did you know that Karl Marx was once a correspondent for Horace Greeley's New York Daily Tribune?
Did you know that Joseph Stalin was studying to become a Russian Orthodox priest when he discovered communism?
That Lev Bronstein stole his jailer's passport and thereafter became known as Leon Trotsky?
That Ho Chi Minh based the opening of Vietnam's constitution on America's constitution?
That the castle of King Ludwig II of Bavaria was the model of Cinderella's castle at Disney World?
That when the Civil War started, Robert E. Lee owned no slaves, but Ulysses Grant did.
Did you know that Oliver Cromwell was hanged and decapitated in 1661, but he died in 1658?
Oh, wait a minute. I think you got your dates wrong. He died 3 years before he was hung and decapitated?
That's right. After Cromwell's death, the monarchy was restored under King Charles II. Since Cromwell had been involved in the execution of Charles I, it was felt only proper that he be punished. Being already dead shouldn't get in the way. So they dug up his body, put him on trial. He was found guilty. He was beaten, hung, and decapitated. Afterwards, his body was thrown in a pit, and his head was displayed on a pole outside of Westminster Hall until 1685. Incidentally, his burial vault was then used by Charles II's illegitimate descendants. Back to our bell time.
Did you know that the famous lover, Casanova, ended his life working as a librarian?
Did you know that David Livingstone was not exactly lost? He just wasn't interested in being found.
That on July 4th, 1776, King George wrote in his diary, "Nothing of importance happened today."
That in 1864, the top U.S. income tax rate was 3%.
That scalping was originally a Dutch idea, not an Indian one.
Thinking back to all those stories, we have a little game to play. We are going to present some hoaxes. All but one of them are real, one isn't. Can you guess which one isn't real?
Wait a minute. How can you have an unreal hoax? For that matter, how can you have a real hoax? If a hoax is something that isn't true, then if you pulled off a hoax, then it didn't happen. But if the hoax isn't true, then did it really happen? And if the hoaxer fools a hoaxee, does that mean that...
Bob, do you understand it really happened?
Oh, yeah. Lots of things really happened to me.
Think of this as a new experience.
Right. We have several stories. Most of the stories actually occurred. One, however, we just made up.
So, is one of them not a hoax, or are the rest of them not hoaxes?
They're all hoaxes. Most of them are hoaxes that really happened, and one is a hoax that didn't really happen, and that's the truth.
Oh, I get it. All you had to do was explain it to me.
Okay, quick, let's go ahead and start.
Okay, the Cottingley Fairies. In 1917, two young girls, Elsie Wright and Frances Griffiths, claimed they played with fairies in the garden of their home in Cottingley, England. They even took photographs to prove their stories. The pictures of the little fairies hovering around in the branches of the shrubbery made world headlines. One of the people who believed the girls' story was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. It was about 55 years later before the girls, old women now, admitted that they had cut out the fairy pictures from a book and had hung them in the branches with paper clips. They couldn't believe that anyone would actually believe the funny fairies.
Okay, my turn. The Cardiff Giant. In 1869, on a farm in upstate New York, near the town of Cardiff, well diggers discovered what appeared to be the body of a petrified man. The diggers had been hired by George Hull, a relative of the farm's owner. News of the discovery spread around the world. Experts scoffed at it, calling it fraud. But the fundamentalists ate it up. And George Hull cashed in. He began exhibiting his petrified man at 50 cents a peek. P.T. Barnum even offered to buy it, but Hull refused. So Barnum made his own man and then sued Hull, claiming his was a fake. At the ensuing trial, Hull admitted that the whole thing started with an argument he had with a fundamentalist preacher. He wondered if he could convince him that the giants that are mentioned in the Bible actually walked the earth. So he carved a body out of gypsum and washed it in sulfuric acid, and then put it in the well. He convinced a preacher and walked away $30,000 richer.
Okay, I've got a story of archaeology. In 1912, a skull and jawbone were retrieved from a gravel pit in Piltdown, a small village near Uckfield, East Sussex, England. The find made headlines. Piltdown man discovered. Many experts at the time thought this find was the fossilized remains of a hitherto undiscovered form of early man. This created two arguments. Some argued that this was the so-called missing link that tied modern man in with his prior monkey-like forebears. But on the other side, there were some scientists who doubted its authenticity because the structure of the remains didn't fit into any accepted classification. The find was made by Charles Dawson, who claimed workmen at the gravel pit had brought fragments of the skull to him. He took them to Arthur Smith Woodward at the Geological Department of the British Museum. After repeated trips to the gravel pit, they discovered more pieces of the skull and half the jawbone, which they were eventually able to piece together. It was 40 years before it was scientifically proven to be a hoax. What they had was the skull of a fairly modern man, the jawbone of an orangutan, and the teeth from a monkey. Who could have perpetrated such a hoax? The chief suspects were Charles Dawson and some friends, and possibly Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of the Sherlock Holmes. Did you know that just down the road from the gravel pit, there still exists a pub called Piltdown Man?
Speaking of pubs, let's take a break from our hoaxes to wet our whistles. I know this place has some amazing characters who come in. A horse came in one day, and the bartender asked, "Why the long face?"
"I know this place." A hard-boiled egg walked in, and the bartender said, "Sorry, we don't serve food."
Two peanuts walked in. One was assaulted.
A pair of jumper cables walked in, and the bartender said, "Don't start anything."
A duck walked in and ordered a beer. The bartender asked, "Are you going to pay for this?" The duck said, "No, put it on my bill."
A chicken walked in, and the bartender said, "Regular or extra crispy?"
Okay. I think my whistle's wet. A recent hoax is the Priory of Sion. The society was founded in France in 1956 as an ultra-conservative Roman Catholic organization. Its origins, however, supposedly go back to the days of the First Crusade with the Knights Templar. Not only did the organization control ancient secrets related to the genealogy of the family of Jesus and his ancestors, but it also contained records showing that the Carolingian dynasty of French kings could be traced right up to the present day.
And if the monarchy were to be restored, who would be the rightful king? Pierre Plantard. And who is Pierre Plantard? He was a minor figure in French occult circles who has spent over two decades trying to establish an organization of conservative Catholic esotericism. He is also the man who created the documents of the history of the Priory of Sion and secretly deposited them in the French National Library to be conveniently discovered by Pierre Plantard.
The story of the Priory got a boost in recent years by author Dan Brown. He claimed authenticity for the society in his book, The Da Vinci Code. Good novel. But no Priory of Sion.
In 1947, an incident occurred outside of Roswell, New Mexico. What is known is that something crash-landed. Something crash-landed. The military claimed it was a high-altitude surveillance balloon. Others claimed it was an alien spaceship. Controversy has surrounded the area ever since with claims of conspiracy and hiding the truth about the visitation of alien beings to Earth. That is not the hoax. That is simply unknown. The hoax part began in 1995 when Ray Santilli presented a film that has been called Alien Autopsy. Santilli is a record producer and filmmaker. He presented his film originally to a select audience at the Museum in London on May 5, 1995.
Although the broadcast version did not show the actual autopsy, the unedited film supposedly does, along with footage of the crash site and interviews with witnesses who attest to its authenticity. In April of 2006, 2 days prior to the UK release of Alien Autopsy, Santilli announced that the film was only partially real, a few frames, while the rest had been reconstructed. This entailed a set constructed in an empty flat and two dummy alien bodies containing sheep brains set in jelly, chicken entrails, and knuckle joints.
I got one. It's about a talking donkey. did I say something?
You're about to.
Abara.
Okay. Tell us a story.
Right. About a talking donkey.
Well, don't laugh until I say something.
Okay. Sorry.
Right. Sorry.
Sometimes I wonder about you two.
Go ahead.
Well, in September of 1873, an Ohio farmer, George Hampton, held a demonstration in the Cleveland auditorium of what he called his talking donkey. He claimed that since Willard, that's the name of the donkey, could communicate with humans, this proved that men descended from lower forms.
Actually, the animal couldn't speak, but it could tap out answers to the problems with his front hoof. Simple math problems and yes or no questions he answered perfectly. Months later, as Mr. Hampton and Willard were getting ready to leave for London to perform in front of Queen Victoria, Willard suffered a massive heart attack and died.
The ensuing autopsy revealed that the heart attack had been triggered by too many electrical shocks. Hampton had an offstage assistant who triggered a wire that gave poor old Willard a shock every time he was supposed to pound his hoof. Too many shocks eventually caused his death.
I don't know why you two want to laugh at that story. The poor old donkey couldn't really talk.
You never know.
Poor Willard. But how about P.T. Barnum's Fiji Mermaid? In August 1842, an Englishman, Dr. J. Griffin, arrived in New York with a most unusual artifact. He claimed it was a mermaid caught off the Fiji Islands. It looked like it had the shriveled-up body of a monkey and the tail of a fish. Barnum exhibited it in New York, and then in London, and then on a nationwide tour.
The Little Mermaid helped boost Barnum's reputation as a master purveyor of freaks. Soon, however, people discovered that Dr. Griffin was one of Barnum's employees, and the Fiji Mermaid was mass-produced by Asian fishermen who sold them as souvenir mermaids. They were made of papier-mâché, formed to simulate limbs, and then they added a jaw, teeth, fins, and a spine of a carp. No such thing as a mermaid, but boy, did the money roll in.
Finally, the girl who bore rabbits. In 1726, an English maid, Mary Toft, claimed she had been assaulted by a very large and very amorous 6-foot-tall rabbit.
Could it have been Harvey?
I doubt it. Mary saw this rabbit.
Oh.
Anyway, people believed her and started doing everything they could to protect their wives and daughters from this thing. A short while later, things got really strange when she collapsed in a field and claimed she was pregnant. 4 weeks later, she gave birth to a dead rabbit. Then every few days, she gave birth to another one, 7 in all. The king sent 2 physicians down to investigate.
Now, here is a boost for science. Even though the doctors were able to float the lungs of one of the dead rabbits and found food in its stomach and dung in its rectum, they pronounced the birth real. A 3rd specialist took Mary to a hospital for close examination. The rabbits stopped coming. It was then that a gardener stepped forward and admitted that he had been supplying Mary with baby rabbits. She then would place the dead rabbits in her womb and claim she had given birth to them.
The reason? Well, her husband had lost his job, and she thought that this story might bring them enough publicity to cause the king to give her a pension. All she got was a prison term.
Well, there they are, all the stories. Now, which one didn't happen?
I don't think any of them happened.
Not happened, Bob. Really happened.
Oh, that makes a difference. Okay, then although that last story sounded strange, and I've talked to pukas, and I also saw Splash, so I know there's mermaids. And if you get in an argument with a preacher, you have to do something. And I know the pub exists, and I've seen Roswell on TV, and I've read the Da Vinci Code, and my wife has a book on the Coddington fairies.
That was Cuttingly.
Oh, the Coddingtons lived down the street from the Cuttingleys, so I'm going to go with the talking donkey.
Why doesn't this surprise me?
Well, you can be surprised, but he's right. The other stories are actual hoaxes that were perpetrated. Willard, however, was made up.
By the way, did you know that another story that was made up was a tale about Sir Walter Raleigh placing his cloak on top of a mud puddle so Queen Elizabeth I would not soil her shoes? It was the invention of Thomas Fuller, a 17th century historian, who used to add such little antidotes to liven up otherwise dull stories.
Sir Walter Scott picked up the story and put it in his 1821 novel, Kenilworth. He also added the little exchange where Sir Walter supposedly says that he will never wash his cloak again, to which Elizabeth instructs her wardrobe keeper to make him a new suit. Romantic story, but never happened.
Incidentally, did you know that the word hoax comes from the old magician's phrase, hocus pocus? And that, some have suggested, comes from the Latin phrase, hoc corpus est, this is my body, which is recited by the Roman Catholic priest during the celebration of Mass.
Is that a hoax?
Nope, he really says it.
Since we've been talking about stories and persons who affected history in one way or another, let's end with some famous people's thoughts about history. History is a pack of lies about events that never happened, told by people who weren't there. That's from George Santayana.
History is nothing but a parade of crimes and adversities. Voltaire.
History is, more or less, bunk. Henry Ford.
I often think it odd that history should be so dull, for a great deal of it must be invention. Jane Austen.
History, an account mostly false of events, mostly unimportant, which are brought about by rulers, mostly knaves, and soldiers, mostly fools. Ambrose Bierce.
The past actually happened, but history is only what someone wrote down. A. Whitney Brown.
God cannot alter the past, but historians can. Samuel Butler.
Historian. An unsuccessful novelist. H.L. Mencken.
History is indeed little more than the register of the crimes, follies, and misfortunes of mankind. Edward Gibbon.
History, Stephen said, is a nightmare from which I am trying to awake. James Joyce.
History is mostly guessing. The rest is prejudice. Will and Ariel Durant.
Well, that's about it for our look into stories and hoaxes of history.
Before we go, Kurt, do you know how you sometimes forget to put the 919 in our phone number?
You mean when we're telling people about the wonderful programming that is offered by the Triangle Radio Reading Service? And that anyone who is print or visually impaired would be able to hear this programming by calling the station, and they would be told how they would be able to get a subchannel receiver which broadcasts all these programs? And to do all that, all they have to do is call 832-5138.
Right. And then I asked the people who would be willing to help underwrite the work of the Triangle Radio Reading Service, which allows us to provide the subchannel receivers and produce programs such as Did You Know and all the rest of the news, entertainment, and informational broadcasts we present to call 919-832-5138. Because they might be out of our area code, and it's important that we hear from them.
Yes, it is. And since we are dealing with things involving history today, I discovered a way to help, so we don't forget the 919.
Okay, what is it?
Well, I just looked at the telephone dial and spelled out the word history to see what numbers would come up.
And?
And the number was 447-8679.
How does that help?
Well, it's obvious. You add the 4 and 4 together and you get 8. Then you take one of the 4s and multiply it by the 8, 32. See? Now you have 832. Next, multiply the 8 times the next number, which is 6, and you get 48. But since this is the third calculation you've done, you have to add 3, so 51. Next, subtract the 6 you just used for the last number, 9, and you get 3. Finally, you just go back to the beginning, 8. And there you are, 832-5138.
But you still forgot the 919.
Well, that just goes to show you what happens when you read too much history.
Is there any chance he's related to Wilbur?
This is Kurt Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thank you for listening in to another edition of Did You Know? This program has been designed for a print and visually impaired audience. If you know someone who is print or visually impaired, TRRS can furnish them with a subchannel receiver so they can hear the special programming that TRRS provides. Simply call 832-5138. Oops, did it again.
This is Parra Tolleson. If you would be willing to help support our efforts in supplying subchannel receivers to anyone who is print or visually impaired and to continue broadcasting our special programming, please call us at 919-832-5138. Kurt, I got you covered.
This is Bob Martin. He always forgets that 919.
But here's something I don't forget. Did You Know can be heard weekly, Thursdays at 9 p.m., Saturdays at noon, and Sunday evenings at 8.
With podcasts available after the initial broadcast.
Good night.